no deal rather than a bad deal. She writes of the country's resilience this way. Despite intense pressure on civilian areas, Ukraine has managed to preserve and even rebuild a degree of normalcy in everyday life. Following the economic shock of the initial invasion by Russia, Western budgetary support, which now makes up 20% of Ukraine's GDP, has allowed the economy to grow by an average of 4.4% over the past 2 years. There has been real household income growth, and inflation remains fairly low. Maritime routes have been open again, with Ukrainian exports up 15% over the past year. And according to the government, some 40% of the weapons Ukraine is using on the front lines are now produced domestically. Despite the extraordinary hardships of war, she writes, Ukrainian society has a kind of adaptability and endurance that may not be fully visible to outsiders. I would add that as the war goes on, Russia will continue paying a high price in lives and in its economy. So let's remember this about Ukraine. It's their country. It is the victim of an aggressive war, and it has fought courageously to preserve its independence. Ukraine deserves better than to be cast aside so that Trump can serve his own narrow ambitions. I'm Mel Gertoff of The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 25th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team and tonight's newscast includes Dave Johnson, Josh Salem, and Mel Gertoff. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Mike Moen, Antonia Gonzalez, Farah Siddiqui, and Kathleen Shannon. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're speaking with Portland City Forester Jen Cairo about the draft urban forest plan. Open now for public feedback.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Portland City Forester Jen Cairo to talk about the Portland Urban Forest Plan. Portland Parks and Rec is holding an open house on Wednesday, February 26th at 5:30 p.m. at the June Key Delta Center for folks to learn about the plan and offer their feedback. So that's what we're going to talk about. Welcome to the show, Jen.
Thank you so much, Althea. I'm pleased to be here today and to talk about the Portland Urban Forest Plan.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking the time. So to start out, let's go there. For folks who don't know, what is the Urban Forest Plan and what does it do?
The Urban Forest Plan is the city's guide for managing trees into the future, managing the urban forest, which is all the trees in the city. So it sets out the vision and the goals and the action plan by which those that vision and goals will be implemented. The one we're working on now has been in process about 12 months. And what folks can comment on at the June Key Delta Community Center tomorrow night is a draft version of that plan that's been released for public comment, and it'll be available for 60 days for folks to comment on.
Well, let's get into some of the things that are in that report, and maybe if people want to give feedback, what they should be considering here. What are some of the ways that Portland's trees serve the community? Like, why is it so important that we have a plan in the first place?
A lot of Portlanders, from what we hear, really value the trees in the city. And they find trees to be quintessential Portland, part of the nature that the Pacific Northwest and our city is famous for. And specifically, trees in urban environments are really critical infrastructure, sort of comparable to the water supply, wastewater management, streets and traffic system, but they provide us with public health benefits. For example, cleaner air, oxygen production. They also provide heat mitigation, which is really important as the climate changes. And as I'm sure you know, and many of your listeners know, just a few years ago, we had the heat dome in the Portland area, and over 50 folks died from the heat impact. And those were in areas where there's little tree canopy. So the shade and cooling that trees provide is a really important part of urban lives. And there are many other features that trees provide in urban setting, like wildlife habitat, walkable streets, connected communities, increased property values. So for all of those reasons, Portlanders like their trees, and the Urban Forest Plan helps articulate what they want in the future for that forest.
Like you mentioned, the Urban Forest Plan has been in the works for a little bit. What are some of the feedback that you've gotten so far?
So the process has been very community-centered. We've really tried to engage with a lot of Portlanders to get their input, and we have had thousands and thousands of comments, which is wonderful, and we have a number of advisory groups and have done presentations to various community organizations, held open houses, things like that, had a survey. And what we've learned from that is that Portlanders do indeed really value their trees. They would like to see more trees, especially as the climate changes and becomes more challenging for all of us. We're hearing strongly that folks appreciate equity in tree canopy. So right now, the forest in Portland is not equitably distributed. West of the Willamette River, the average canopy cover is 54%, while east of the Willamette, where 80% of Portlanders live, it's only 21%, which is roughly on par with the average canopy cover of LA. So we've heard a lot of feedback about folks wanting to increase canopy in low canopy areas. We've also heard that tree maintenance costs are a barrier for folks having trees and caring for trees, so wanting to address that. And I think a fourth item that we've heard emerge is a real interest to be involved, like community stewardship and connection with the city's tree programs is a desire as well.
I'm curious, what are some of the challenges that have to be considered when looking at this community desire for greater tree cover across parts of the city that don't currently have it? Like, what are some of the things that have to be considered in order to try to fix that?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I'm glad you asked that. There are a number of factors. One, as I shared, some of the feedback we've had is concern about cost. Property owners having to maintain their property and feeling challenged by that. So how can we make that less expensive for folks to do? And for example, right now, the city's policy is that street trees, which are actually city property, they have to be maintained by the adjacent property owner. So one of the things we've heard strongly through developing the plan is that folks would like that policy to change. And thanks to Portland Clean Energy Community Benefits Funds, we have funding and a plan to start switching that so the city will maintain those trees. So there's a really good illustration of one of the challenges and how it might be addressed going forward. Other challenges are there needs to be space. You know, a tree is a living thing, and sometimes we forget that what we see above ground is only part of the story. There's a root system there that is essential to the survival of the tree, and so having that space and the proper soil, those are challenges as well. And we also need to have all of the other infrastructure that we all need in a city. We do need to have housing and roads and transit lines. And so finding the space for the trees and having all those other things is something we have to work on as well.
I'm curious, because this also sort of has a historical angle of, you know, how did we get here from way back when? How has Portland's tree canopy changed over time?
We study the tree canopy on a regular basis. We use LIDAR data. And if anyone's interested, that's all on our web pages. They could look at it specifically. But the summary is that for several decades, canopy in Portland was growing. And then our last measurement, which was about 3 years ago, we saw the first decline in average canopy cover that we had seen ever. And the loss was about equivalent to the size of Mount Tabor Park. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with Mount Tabor Park. So when we are working on the Portland Urban Forest Plan, again, we're hearing a lot of folks say they would like more trees and in more places where they aren't. And one of our goals with putting the plan together and then implementing it through the actions that'll be in the plan is to reverse that trend and keep trees that are healthy and safe now and add more trees back. So we're gaining again, as we were in the past in Portland.
With the recent heat waves that we've experienced hitting different parts of the city differently, you mentioned this a little bit, you know, shade equity has been a focus for folks, for advocates, for elected officials. How does that fit into the plan here? Is there more urgency around that part of the urban forest plan?
Yes, Althea, there is more urgency around that. We've heard that loud and clear from the feedback we've gotten so far on the draft Portland Urban Forest Plan. As I mentioned before, the distribution of trees in Portland is dramatically uneven, and the Willamette River is the dividing line. And what we've heard from folks is that they really want the programs that the city offers and the partnerships with community organizations and neighborhoods to really help increase canopy in the areas that have less. And as far as shade equity goes, you know, that is integral to where the trees are. We need more shade in the areas that have less trees to have that cooling, hence shade equity. And trees are one of the less expensive and longest lasting, because trees typically are longer lived, especially the ones that we aim to plant. So it can really help mitigate things like urban heat island effect. And again, the focus is to add canopy, plant trees in the areas that don't have a lot right now. So that will really be helping with shade equity over time. And right now, we have been very actively engaging in planting in the low canopy and low income parts of town.
I wonder if you can discuss a little bit the difference in impact between a young tree versus a mature tree on the surrounding neighborhood.
Yes, that's a good question. It's a big difference. So a young tree is essential to our future forests. Like all living things, trees decline and die, and we need to plant new ones. However, for them to give the services that we're talking about and to create better shade equity, environmental justice, and all those services, public health, climate action, they need to become larger trees. It's the smaller the tree is, the fewer of those services are generated by the tree. It's the larger form trees. You think about like the canopy spread, the leaves or the needles on a larger tree, how many more there are than on a small tree, whether it's young or just a small type of tree. You can kind of imagine that it is a vast difference in the services that we get. The young trees too, there are specific best practices that we all want to use when we're selecting what type of tree to put in selecting an area. Is it the right tree for that area? And then the quality of the tree that's planted, that we call it the stock, the material, and then how it's planted. Those are all really important too. If any of those are lacking, that tree may not make it very long and may have public safety issues in the future or be shorter lived than it might be. And then we get less of the services that we want from our forest.
Well, right, getting a tree to full maturity is a year-long effort. I believe there's even an idiom about that. But there's also been a few instances in the past few years of trees being planted by the city not getting the water or the care to have them reach maturity. Where does the maintenance component of the urban forest fit into this plan?
So when trees are, we're planting thousands and thousands of trees each year, and it's to be expected when we look at programs across the nation, even the world, not all of those will survive. It is difficult to be a tree in an urban environment, particularly a street surrounded by hardscape. And what we do is called establishment care. It's essential, like watering in the summer is one element, to get a tree, young tree, off to a good start. And we just actually posted our annual planting report online. And our average survival rate for the trees that urban forestry is involved in planting, including with contractors and partners, is 95%, which is a really respectable number. We have relatively few losses. So we will see around the city some young trees that don't make it. However, we continue to monitor actively and correct so that the vast majority do make it. And you had questions about maintenance, that when those new trees are planted, that initial maintenance is the establishment care I talked about. It is primarily watering. It's also putting mulch around the base of the tree, not against the trunk, but kind of in a donut shape to keep moisture in, so to help with that watering element to keep weeds away. And there's also restaking the trees until they've developed enough of a structure and a basal form so that they're resistant to wind, and also some pruning to give them the future form they need. Did you have other questions about maintenance specifically?
I think that that pretty much covers it. I think I wanted to just sort of clarify for the listener a little bit about what that kind of timeline of maintenance looks like over the lifetime. And I know you mentioned earlier that some of that cost is being passed away from maybe the adjacent property owner or some of that responsibility as well.
Yeah, that's starting. And that's really a big deal, Althea. The City of Portland's policy for decades has been the adjacent property owner having to maintain the street tree. And we in Urban Forestry, since I've been here, have advocated with city officials and past councils to try to change that policy, as have many stakeholders and community members. So we're really excited that that is changing. Really looking forward to getting our first pilot program up so we can learn and then have that inform the whole citywide program. There's another one I'll mention too, also funded by PSEF. And that is, for the first time ever, we are developing a private property tree care support program. And the intention on that is, recall that some of the feedback we've gotten through developing the Portland Urban Forest Plan is the cost of tree maintenance is a burden and a barrier to folks. So this is specifically to help address that. We're building a program where private property tree care can get funding from the city, so it is less expensive. And also, we can help make sure it's the proper care, so it's done correctly by experienced certified staff. That's also really exciting and helpful when it comes to maintenance for our future forests.
Well, I want to circle back to the open house on Wednesday. What can folks expect if they come on down?
The open house, a number of staff there, our team that have been working on developing the Portland Urban Forest Plan, a lot of materials, so maps and the draft goals, like we talked about, the draft content of the plan, and various opportunities to talk with people to give feedback or write feedback. And it's a really drop-in type of arrangement. It runs from 5:30 to 7, so fairly long. So folks can stop in for 10 minutes or less, or they can stay for an hour. And there'll also be a lot of opportunity for community members who stopped in to talk to each other and exchange ideas right there and share them with the staff who are collecting those thoughts.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't get to touch on?
I would say we've really focused on a lot of community input to the plan. You know, this is Portlanders' forest. The trees are for all of us in the city and for the next 10 years and some. So it would really be great to hear from a lot of community members if they could take some time to write in a comment or attend an open house. That would be really helpful so that we make sure the plan captures what the community wants to see.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Althea. I appreciate having had the opportunity.
That was Portland City Forester Jen Cairo speaking with me about the Portland Urban Forest Plan. Portland Parks and Recreation is holding an open house on Wednesday, February 26th at 5:30 p.m. at the June Key Delta Center for folks to learn more about the plan and offer their feedback. More information about the Portland Urban Forest Plan is online at portland.gov/trees/Portland Urban Forest Plan. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The ongoing outbreak of bird flu has spread widely across both wild bird populations and commercial poultry operations, raising concerns for animal health, food production, and the broader economy. Right now, there have been 67 confirmed cases of bird flu or avian influenza in humans in the U.S. Humans aren't the main ones impacted right now. It's going to be cows and chickens that are at risk of death. The flu has spread widely among domesticated chickens and wild birds. H5N1 is now endemic in some types of waterfowl, and wild birds can transmit the influenza throughout their migration. Here's what the experts have to say about these trends.
I'm Carol Cardona. I'm a veterinarian and have a PhD in pathology. I'm here at the University of Minnesota, where I serve as the Ben Pomeroy Chair in Avian Health. And my research these days, I've done a lot of different types of research, but these days I work on maintaining continuity of business. So during a highly pathogenic avian influenza outbreak in poultry, when that happens in the United States, there are movement controls that help restrict movement so that the virus can't leave the farm and all those other farms that are around it. So my group does risk assessments to determine how movements can happen from the uninfected farms that surround an infected farm without spreading disease. So we know that this outbreak, if we say that it started in 2022 in the United States, that it has spread to all 50 states. If we go back further and ask when this particular strain of virus began to spread, it started spreading in 1996, and it has spread globally since then. So we know that it has spread very far and very wide, and we know that based on poultry infections, which sort of serve as sentinels. And we hear some about wild bird infections as well. But, you know, with 9,000 avian species worldwide, what we know about which species are involved at a total level, we probably know only a smidgen of that. Primarily, what we do know is that the virus now is endemic in some types of wild birds, mostly the anseriformes, so the ducks, the wild free-flying ducks that move through our country. And so we know that that's partly how we keep getting these seasonal influenza outbreaks. And we know that a large number of mammalian species have also been infected. And those mammalian species, you know, how much we know about that, we probably know very little. So there's approximately, you know, 2,000 mammalian species in the U.S. and 3,000 avian species. So of those 3,000, maybe we know a lot about 5 or 10. So I think that tells you, and then we sporadically know a few things about some of the others. And I think you'll hear more from Dr. Pateski on some of those ways that we can know and what we do know in different ways.
My name's Maurice Pateski. I'm an associate professor of cooperative extension at the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. And my lab focuses on, among other things, we focus on remote sensing of wild waterfowl around the world and how we can use technology to make daily predictions and forecasted predictions about where wild birds, primarily waterfowl like ducks and geese, are relative to the tens of thousands of poultry, commercial swine, and livestock facilities in the US, Canada, and beyond. Yeah, so as Dr. Cardona kind of alluded to, we don't know a lot, but some of the things that we think we know are that wild waterfowl, primarily migratory ducks and geese, are the primary reservoir of this virus. And they're most waterfowl are migratory, so they can literally move thousands of miles every single year during fall and winter migration. And for example, I live in California in the Central Valley. And in that Central Valley of California, during the winter or late fall, we go from about 600,000 resident waterfowl to over 8 million waterfowl. So right now, you drive anywhere in the Central Valley of California, you're going to see ducks and geese. And unfortunately, we decided, where we have our dairy infrastructure and our poultry infrastructure, it overlaps spatially with where those waterfowl hang out during the fall and winter. And then when they move back up again in the spring, we get back down to that 600,000 or so number. So if you have 1,000 dairies and you have 600 or so poultry facilities and you have 8 million waterfowl and they kind of spatially overlap with each other, that's where diseases can be transmitted. In California, like the rest of the country and world to a certain extent, we've lost a lot of our natural wetlands. So we've lost about 95% of our wetlands. That's where ducks and geese spend 10 to 14 hours a day this time of year before they go on their feeding flights. So they use what I call a suboptimal habitat, dairy lagoons, flooded rice fields, just ponding from rain. They'll use that as their habitat. And unfortunately, a lot of that spatially overlaps with proximity to these farms. And then when these birds go on their feeding flights and things like that, you get aerosols that can be generated. Their habitat overlaps with some other wild animals. So you can get what we call mechanical transmission. So the poop, which might have virus and other diseases on it, can be mechanically transmitted on the feet of rodents, for example, we think, and then transmitted into these barns. So it's, you know, from the way I kind of look at this from a big picture transmission perspective, it's that kind of confluence and overlapping of wild animals and domesticated farm animals that has created a higher probability of transmission. It's not the only way the virus is transmitted, but it certainly makes it a riskier kind of scenario. There's kind of like a whole smorgasbord of different types of farms, organic or conventional, layer and broiler facilities, the places where you and I might get our eggs or our meat from. They have different ventilation systems. So there's a lot of different variables there. For the data that I've looked at for specific companies, and for if you look at the USDA's 2022 HIPAATH AI interim report, the way the primary risk within a 20-day window of farms that break with HIPAATH AI are facilities that have, I'll just call it high waterfowl abundance, high amounts of ducks and geese within about 4 kilometers of that facility. Now, that makes sense, especially when you overlay where we're finding HIPAATH AI detections. So we look at the waterfowl in that 4 kilometer area, we look at when HIPAATH AI is detected, and we do some disease modeling. And if you take that variable, and then you also take other variables related to, you know, kind of on-farm biosecurity, so things like ventilation systems, things like weather, without getting into all the details, whether the farm or barn has what we call curtains. So curtains are these things that go up and down on the long axis of these barns, which can be several hundred yards long. Those are the kinds of variables that you can combine those together and really identify what variables are the most predictive when it comes to what I call outward facing biosecurity and inward facing biosecurity. And I think just from a holistic perspective, about 99% of the research and effort that the poultry industry has made and academics have made on protecting poultry is really what's going on inside those walls, what we call operational and physical biosecurity. And what I'm trying to do is integrate that with what's going on outside the facility with respect to the waterfowl that might be roosting around one farm one day and then might be roosting around a different farm the next day based upon all kinds of environmental predictors.
I'm Dr. Jada Thompson. I'm Associate Professor of Agricultural Economics and Agribusiness at the University of Arkansas, Division of Agriculture. I predominantly study animal health economics with the emphasis on poultry and poultry production systems. And so I'm HPAI and bird flu in birds has been a big form of research in my studies recently. This is the question for why are egg prices high? Big, large scale animal outbreaks are going to impact what kind of foods we're eating. So if you're talking about a layer system, this is going to impact the birds that are laying the eggs. Well, if there's no birds to lay eggs, there are no eggs to have, and then we have a supply shortage, and that leads to higher prices because of supply and demand dynamics. If we talk about the cost in the system, so it's not just those layers, it's also the breeding system, so that prolongs the cost of the disease outbreak and prolongs the replenishment of that system. And so when we start talking about the disease outbreak, it's not even just the direct impact and the biological lag to replenishment, but it's also the multiplicative impact in terms of further upstream on that system. When we start thinking about the cost of a disease outbreak, I'm a consumer, we're all consumers first and foremost, even those producers. And so I think we think of the retail prices. And so obviously we see the changes in retail prices for my eggs at the grocery store. I see the changes in my chicken prices or turkey or milk or whatever the case is. But there's also the cost of the biosecurity that Dr. Pateski was talking about, just this, these practices have to go into place, and those are additional costs. There's additional costs for the monitoring and surveillance, for the cleaning and disinfections. There's additional costs for the testing, and that's going to be to the producer, to the integrator, to government officials, to the testing labs. There's also time and effort involved in all of these different situations. And then also us as a consumer, where we're having to process our risk perceptions of those types of foods. And so the costs aren't just the direct ones that we can see. And so when we start thinking about how those affect the entire supply chain, they are all up and down the supply chain, and they're multiplicative along the line.
H5 influenza isn't going away. We're going to have changes in how we raise animals and how we do things, because this virus will become endemic and it will continue to be a scourge. My big thing is, I think that disease control should be separated from trade, because I think they're separate issues, and we shouldn't be able to choose trade over disease control or the health of humans and animals.
Farmers need help. We're dealing with something unprecedented, and that there are no short-term solutions. We need to think medium to long-term at this point. And I think ultimately we really need to think strategically for the first time about where we have our animal agricultural facilities relative to